UK Wine Show, show number 65. Steve Smith on Terroir. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 65 for the 24th of August, 2007. My name is Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with Steve Smith, Master of Wine, Viticulturist, and Managing Director of Craggy Range from Hawke's Bay, New Zealand. This week we're continuing our discussion on terroir. Unusually for a Frenchman, last week's interview with Louis Latour downplayed the effects of terroir a bit. While Steve Smith has some quite definite beliefs about how terroir expresses itself on the wines. But before we get into that, let's get down to earth with our own Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. In the news this week, the Aussies see beauty in bag-in-box and they search for new names for fortified wines. But first, a quick update on Germany's renaming of Mosel-Saar-Ruhr. As of the 1st of January 2008, the region will be known simply as Mosel. The new law will apply to wines made from the 2007 vintage. It's thought that Mosel is far easier to say and will avoid confusion that the wine might be a three-region blend. Next, Australia's fortified wine producers are looking for names to replace Sherry, Port and Tokai. They're being helped with a $500,000 grant from the federal government. The Muscat of Rutherglen Group will implement the research project on behalf of the Australian wine industry. Port and Sherry have been on the list for changing for some time, but Australia will sign an agreement with the EU next year saying it will stop using the names within 12 months. Tokai has already been eliminated for wines going to the EU and is being phased out over a 10-year period throughout the rest of the world. And finally, Australia's bag-in-box wine container has been shortlisted in a poll to find the country's most iconic design. The 4-litre wine packaging device is up there on Home Beautiful magazine's online list, along with other Aussie designs such as the Ford Ute and Speedos. That's all this week, but 20 years ago in 1987, Sainsbury's and Tesco started selling wine in tetrabrick cartons. Normally used for juice, the tetrabrick is a good container for wine, but definitely hasn't caught on in the UK. Just 2 years ago, French rabbit wines were launched in a tetra container, but it seems they're having more success in the States than over here. Like the Aussies, we Brits like the convenience of bag-in-box, but draw the line at wine in juice containers. Don't forget you can get more detail on these news stories on the news homepage of our website 3050.co.uk. That's it from me. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers for that, Jane. Well, bless the Aussies for their cutting-edge design. But on a sensible note, the bag-in-the-box is a piece of high-tech wizardry made up of many layers. When I was a student quaffing wine by the bag, many were just simple clear plastic bags that tended to let a lot of oxygen in through and quite a short shelf life. But students, they certainly didn't need to last that long. These days, the bag's made up of multiple layers, including oxygen barriers to help improve shelf life, although oxygen still pours in through the tap. A lot of people think that the quality of wine is low. Certainly the wines are made to be immediately drinkable, which does mean a short shelf life and only suitable for certain styles of wine. But often the same wine can be bought in a bottle. So if it's in a bottle, does that make it better? I had a look at the Sainsbury's web offer, and the most expensive wine they had was £19 for a 3-litre bag in the box, which was equivalent to £4.75 for a 75 centilitre bottle. The wine was First Cape Limited Release Sauvignon Semillon, with claims that the wine stays fresh for up to 2 weeks after opening. I think the wines on offer are still fairly cheap, but they do meet a demand and they are quite convenient. Next up, we have the interview with Steve Smith, Master of Wine, Viticulturalist and Managing Director of Craggy Range. We're talking about terroir and Steve has some definite views on terroir. Hi, I'm here with Steve Smith from Craggy Range. You're the Viticulturalist and General Manager.
Managing Director at Craggy Range and look after all the wines and viticultural stuff, yeah.
Excellent, excellent. You're also an MW as well, so you're a viticulturist and an MW, so it's quite an interesting combination.
Yeah, I mean, my love is viticulture and the whole MW thing was a great way to understand everything else about wine, so it's great to make wine on one side of the world and sell it on the other side of the world. So.
Excellent. We're going to be talking today about terroir, but I thought we'd just touch on Craggy Range for a while first.
Yep.
How long have you guys been going?
Our first vintage was 1999. The first vintage off our own estates was 2001. And, I mean, we're sort of unique in New Zealand in that we're based in Hawke's Bay, but we make single vineyard wines from right throughout the country. So it doesn't matter where your winery is, it matters where your vineyard is.
Okay, but if you're bringing fruit up from Mataga, that's a heck of a long journey up from Mataga to Hawke's Bay. It must take about 10 hours.
It takes more than that. It takes about 30 hours to get there. But so we pick the grapes into little 10-kilo containers and put them in a chiller, put them in a refrigerated truck, and it's sort of no difference from the grapes you know, sitting in a chiller at your own winery. So it works fine.
Your winery is very, very nice. I went and visited it last trip out to New Zealand, and it is a very nice winery. You must be well-funded.
Yeah, we're very lucky. I mean, my life's been in New Zealand wine, and I had the sort of ambition to do a specialist single vineyard producing winery, and I happened to run into a fellow by the name of Terry Peabody, who's a businessman in Australia, and his family were looking for an investment in wine. So, you know, they've provided some fantastic funding, and we've had a great concept, and we both want to do the same thing, which is make great wine.
And you know, your wines are in the UK. They've been in there here for a while now.
Yeah, we've been sending wine to the UK since 2000, and you know, a lot of them go to the on-premise. If you don't find them in on-premise, it's at the fine wine area in Waitrose. But no, it's a great market for us.
Today's interview is about terroir. Do you want to just give us your quick definition of what you think terroir is?
Yeah, I mean, Matt Kramer had the best one, which was a sense of somewhereness, which is something comes from a place and it grows in a place and it reflects where that product reflects where it's grown and made. And the thing that people often talk about soil and climate as being terroir, but it's, I think, the third component of terroir people forget, and that is culture. And when the French talk about it, they talk about soil, climate, and culture. And culture is the people and the way the local people have adapted to their environment and grow their grapes and make their wine is a reflection of the terroir of the area. So it's not just a pure soil and climate issue. So it's just when something tastes like it comes from somewhere, it's real. And there are characteristics in a wine that can come from nowhere else.
When you say culture, do you mean things like maybe the foods and the cuisine that people eat and making wine to go with that food?
That's part of it. It's human culture. It's what everything, I mean, a person has to grow a grape and make a wine. They don't happen by themselves, or if they do, everything's bad. So someone makes some decisions. So it's the culture and the human form that a particular area takes. So that includes food, it includes how people live, how people adapt to the climate, and all of those things are interacted in the wines that they make. So
what do you think is the main driver of the concept of terroir or the style of wine? Is it climate, culture, soils?
Our climate is the most important thing to get right to start with. So for whatever variety that you want to grow, you need to operate in a climatic parameter that's going to work for it. The ideal climate is a climate where that variety just ripens. So whichever variety you want to choose, it just ripens.
Is that to give the lot time on the vine?
Exactly. If a grape ripens too quickly, it is not going to express the characteristics of that area very well. So whichever variety you choose, you need to find an environment where it just ripens. And then you select a site or a soils that are in that area that will make sure that in most years it does ripen.
Okay.
So the climate is most important first, and then you've got to select the soils.
Okay, I did an interview with a geologist a few months ago, and he was talking about porosity and permeability, you know, the way the water flows through the rocks or the soil and how much water it holds.
Yep.
So obviously, if you're in a very wet area, you want soils that are quite free draining.
Yeah, I think in it's different in the new world because we're allowed to irrigate.
Yeah,
so generally what you want to do is you will generally choose soils that are relatively free draining, particularly if you have summer or autumn rainfall, because you don't want that water hanging around.
It's a bit like Hawke's Bay, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Hawke's Bay or most parts of New Zealand, we're a maritime, you know, climate. We're influenced by the sea, so we will get a little bit of summer rainfall. But I mean, if you look at a lot of the great vineyards, a vigneron will actually like to have, there's always stones in it.
Yeah.
So that provides, no matter where you are in the world, that provides free drainage.
Yep.
And in the new world, if there's not enough clay to hold on to water, we will use irrigation to make sure the vine has enough water just to survive, not grow too much. So the application of water in a very stony vineyard becomes a very intensive and precise process.
I heard a winemaker describe Gimlet Gravels, which is the region in Hawke's Bay, you guys have got a fair bit of vineyards, as
the closest thing to hydroponics that you can see.
Well, I mean, people often sort of criticise the Gimlet gravels for being hydroponic, particularly those that aren't in it. And it's not really the case, because hydroponics, by definition, means that you're also adding an enormous amount of nutrient.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't have to add much nutrient. There is, the soils are very stony. We would not survive without irrigation. But there are lenses of, there is enough fertility in that soil, in the parcels of silt and clay that you find in the lenses further down, to make sure that the vine has enough nutrition to survive. So, I mean, I look at that that hydroponic criticism of the Gimlet gravels and dismiss it, because it's not correct.
You've got quite a tie into Gimlets. You were the chairman.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm looking from the other point of view. I was chairman of the association when we founded it, and I mean, it's a pretty interesting project in terms of naming something with a link to terroir. I mean, the name is indelibly linked to a piece of land, and the way we did it has never been done anywhere in the world before.
You've got grapes varieties grown from Otago all the way to Hawke's Bay.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't really realise how long and thin New Zealand is. There's quite a bit of latitude difference. It's almost how far?
I mean, with the wine growing areas, it's from 37 degrees down to 45 degrees, so it's 8 degrees of latitude, which is huge. I mean, it's enough distance to almost stretch from Paris to Madrid. So,
yeah.
And within that, you get, you know, the north of the country is subtropical. Obviously, we can't grow too many grapes up there because of the rainfall.
Yep.
But the bottom of the country is, you know, there's nothing between there and Antarctica. So tropical fish at one end, icebergs at the other.
Yeah.
And in between, you have this range of climates that is incredibly variable. And, you know, the Gimlet Gravels is as warm as Bordeaux and as warm as the Rhone. Bannockburn in central Otago is as cool as Champagne. There are parts of New Zealand that are as cool as the Mosel. And then you get the little bits in between. So it's a fascinating little country. And I think as we develop and get more specialist at finding the right variety to grow on the right site, you're going to see a real expression of New Zealand that we don't currently see.
Getting back into the soils and terroir, is there any particular soils, like the expression of the soil in the wine? I was talking to Joel Peterson at Ravenswood a wee while ago, and he was saying that it's not necessarily what the minerals and trace elements that are in the soil, but it's how the vine adapts with the lacking, perhaps, of some of them. Like in Puhifume, they're lacking iron in the soil, so the vineyards adapt to that, and that may be one of the reasons for this.
Yeah, I think it's probably an imprecise science. I think those of us, and I mean, Joel would be in a similar position, making a whole bunch of Zinfandel from different places.
Yeah.
When you see the same variety growing in different spots, on different soils, in a similar climate, you get a different characteristic, there is no doubt. And you know, I see a minerality on our Gimlet Gravel Chardonnays that I don't see anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that is and how it got there, I don't know. But there's this link between stones that you see and a minerality that you see on the palate of the wine. But we don't know what compound that is. We don't know what causes that. It just happens.
Okay.
I think with soils, you get a much bigger difference on the texture of the wine than you do on the flavours in the wine.
Oh, okay.
So how the wine feels.
Is it like the structure of the tannins, or is it...
It can be tannins. It can be tannins of acidity and the balance of acidity and the type of acidity, pH, other phenolics that are there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting component in wine that we don't talk about in the New World enough. And if you go to France, the great vignerons in France talk about how the wine feels in the mouth. They don't necessarily talk about flavors, they talk about the feel.
Yep.
And that is the thing that often gives more pleasure than anything. And in my experience, you get a much bigger impact of the soil on the texture of the wine than you do on the flavors.
Oh, that's interesting. So the grape variety is still driving a lot of the flavor compounds in the wine, but the way the texture...
Yeah. I mean, if you... that's assuming that you've got a variety that performs well on a number of different sites.
Yeah, sure.
So you're not saying about where here's a soil that's heavy and the grapes will never ripen versus one that's got a lot of stones and it will ripen. So you're not talking about those differences. You're talking about here is three great sites for a great variety that will make great wine on it. One's got stony soils, one's got clay soils, and one's got maybe old stony soils that aren't the alluvial soils that are on the other site. They will produce three different wines that are more related to texture than flavour.
Even if you keep the vineyard, the winemaking practices
yep.
the same?
Yep.
Oh, that's interesting. I'd never really heard that before.
Yeah.
So that's quite good.
Yeah. So I see a character in the Gimlet Gravels wines, and the white wines I see a minerality, in the red wines a character called Gimlet Dust, which is a sort of a minerally dusty character that you see in the really good wines on the off that area. We have a fantastic Sauvignon Blanc vineyard on really stony soils in Marlborough, which gives a minerality that we don't see on the soils from the heavier sites. So it's really interesting.
What are the main types of soils? You hear Camaggiore and clay and all this sort of stuff, but there must be general groupings of soils that you grow grapes on, alluvial soils from the most important
thing for a grape growing soil is that you have really good drainage. Mm-hmm. And that can be in two or three different forms. If it's a heavy soil and it's on a slope, you can get good drainage because the water runs off the slope.
Sure.
Many of the great vineyard soils around the world have got stones in them because those stones provide great drainage.
Yep.
So that aspect of soil is really important. The physical characteristic of it is important. So, and then you have the whole range, and you get the chalky soils, the clay soils, the alluvial soils, which are stony like you have in the Medoc. They all have different variations of achieving the same thing. And it's the way they interact with their climate as well. So, in Bordeaux, again, which gets a little bit of summer rainfall, those stony soils are really important. They don't have many slopes. They have gentle slopes, but not steep ones.
Yep.
And it's really important that they have stony soils so that any rainfall they get at vintage time drains away.
Is there any generality between the soils that you can say in terms of the expression? Like you said about the texture, but do heavier soils create,
they're being very general here, but heavier soils with more clay, if you're looking at white wines, tend to produce white wines that are a little richer, a little rounder, maybe a little fatter in texture, whereas the stony soils tend to produce wines that are a little more linear and tighter on the palate. And then you get the sort of variations in between that. So we don't have much limestone in New Zealand, so I haven't seen really the effect of limestone compared to non-limestone. That will come as we express some of those sites. But some of the vineyards that I've seen on limestone certainly have a savouriness and austerity about them, which is just very serious and fantastic. So, I mean, very early stages of understanding, but there's no doubt that those different forms of soil have a difference. Make a difference.
Just one last thing, because we've been about vineyard winemaking. I was talking to Jamie Good, who's a wine writer over here, and he was talking about minerality, and he mentioned, and he didn't say 100%, but he implied that maybe some of the minerality that people get in the wine is maybe reductive winemaking processes.
Oh, he's definitely right there. There's no doubt that happens, and you can generate flintiness and minerality by the way that you make some of the wine. So But if you're making, for example, a relatively simple variety like Riesling, we're using, cultured yeast so that you've got no indigenous yeast and no unusual fermentations, you still get minerality that's not related to reductive winemaking. So he's absolutely right. You can influence this. And I think a lot of white Burgundy is that minerality and flintiness that you see in white Burgundy is an impact of indigenous yeast ferments and long malolactic ferments and a lot of contact with lees and all these sorts of things.
Which the contact with lees is a reductive process, isn't
it? Well, it's if you don't keep stirring those lees up, they can become quite reductive.
Because the lees are they absorbing?
They absorb oxygen. Yeah. So lees absorb oxygen. So they
it
become
removes the oxygen, which means there's an oxygen depth, that's reductive.
Yep. So he's absolutely right there. That can definitely happen. So it's an area that science hasn't been able to prove where these textural components and this minerality comes from. We just see it in wine. Some of it's due to winemaking, but vineyard site can have a huge effect.
Okay. I think we'll wrap it up there.
Fantastic.
Thanks very much.
Absolute pleasure.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Steve. I've always been a bit sceptical about growing vines on stones and the wine tasting and smelling like stones. I thought geologist Richard Seeley back in show 44 and 45 had some good points about drainage of water and water retention, permeability and porosity. So I was really interested when Steve said the soils influence the texture of the wine, perhaps through the pH and the types of acidity and tannins. With heavier soils creating fatter, richer wines, while better draining stonier soils create a more austere wine.
I thought that was very interesting, and I'm going to be keeping an eye on that over the next year or so. And if I can give you some examples that show this, I'll be more than happy to. Next week, we're going to be talking to Mike Ratcliffe, Director of Wines of South Africa, on what's been happening in South Africa since the end of apartheid and what the future may bring. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company.